Welcome to the 108th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 2 years to the day since Bangladesh's 595-8 declared in Wellington became the highest total made by any team that has then gone on to lose. Welcome to the podcast that is always up for grabbing defeat from the jaws of victory.
And we love a good underdog on this podcast. This episode, we are going to be talking about the future top dogs of the cricketing world, the primary school cricketing world record attempt, which is something Andy's been having his eye on. I'm going to be talking about quite a fun new venture down at the other end of the world, down in New Zealand. Andy's going to be telling us about some of the controversy and the nuance surrounding getting a runner. We've all wanted to get a runner occasionally when we've been out playing a club game, and Andy's going to be telling us a bit about the history of that. And we've also been reading the remarkable book Chasing Shadows, The Life and Death of Peter Roebuck. Now, if you're enjoying the podcast as you're listening, please do hop onto iTunes and leave us a review there. It's actually a really useful and valuable way for other listeners to other cricket fans to hear about us and join the Reverse Sweat Radio community. So if you're feeling generous, please do hop onto iTunes. Now, Andy, the primary school cricketing world record attempt, tell us about this.
Well, so this summer, England will host the Cricketing World Cup and will host it as favourites, actually. But I think with all these big tournaments, there's an opportunity to do a lot more for the game. And Capital Kids Cricket, which is a charity that I hadn't come across, but looking into, has done a huge amount for the game, particularly pushing it in British state schools, but also doing a lot to push the game internationally, including even in Syria, even in a sort of Syrian war zone situation. But they are attempting to make the most of the enthusiasm that will hopefully accompany the World Cup by attempting to break a world record. And they're going to do that on Hackney Marshes. 2,500 primary school children are going to play 100 games on one day as part of a cricketing festival and hopefully set this world record. This has a particular resonance to me because Hackney Marshes was where it's kind of often thought of really as a footballing land. You know, if you ever go past on a Saturday afternoon, there'll be tons and tons of games, and if you go past it, it really feels like a kind of heartbeat of community sport. You know, my dad used to play there when he was younger, and he can't go past it without coming up with some sort of nostalgic story. So I'm delighted that cricket will be taking it over, and I'm delighted also that this is primary school age. I mean, you know, we've got to build the passion for a sport. We've got to get it to the stage where, or you know, we've at least got to try and get it to the stage where there's some competition for the demon football monopolizing everyone's attention. So yes, this is worth getting excited about.
Where is that place in India where, you know, where that iconic place where you see the pictures of all of those games happening on the same sort of park together? Because it sounds, you always see that and you think, oh, there are 40 games going on at the same time. Isn't that a nightmare? Doesn't everyone get their balls mixed up and not quite know which, you know, which pitch they're fielding on? This sounds as if it's going to be sort of that on steroids and frankly a complete logistical nightmare, but so much more of a joy because of that. And it's always a question around these big sporting events, and it comes up around the Olympics as well, about how do you actually get long-term benefits out of something like this in terms of furthering the sport in that place. It was interesting during the, you know, there was that big debate after the 2005 Ashes and cricket went off free-to-air TV in the UK about how do we leverage big events going forward to actually get the new generation involved. And what's great about this is it absolutely is the kind of thing that as a kid, particularly if you've never played cricket before, would just capture your imagination and give you a way into the game that you probably wouldn't have otherwise. So exactly as you say, anything that can be done to try and, you know, leverage these big, often quite exclusive events and actually get them out into the community is such a vital thing.
I completely agree. I mean, I think the dream here is you have kids who are watching a successful England team in a home tournament, and then going out and being told that they can break a world record. You know, and I think if you're part of something with 2,500 other children, I mean, the sheer size of it, I think, will be very exciting.
The reality is we'll probably crash out in the group stages and Hackney Marshes will suffer a monsoon and there'll be rain stop play. But anyway, look, that's just pessimism.
It's January.
Touch wood.
We can
fingers
dream.
Crossed.
Now, you've been looking into a sort of event that in its own way is a very, very creative and exciting one.
Yeah, so this is something that caught my eye that's happening week after next, actually, down in New Zealand, just across the sea from me. And it just struck me as a typically Kiwi attitude towards sports. So we all know that, you know, everyone in New Zealand is a kind of international level at several different sports. It's just what they have in their blood. And they've set up a new trophy, which is a an opportunity to commemorate the rugby union player Jonah Lumo and the cricketer Martin Crowe, both of whom now sadly not of this world. And this will consist of a 2020 match at the beautiful Hagley Oval in Christchurch. On the South Island. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it's got a bit of a catch. So one team is a cricket team, and it's made up of a brilliant lineup of ex-cricketers, actually. So Grant Elliott, who we saw on the World Cup final stage not too long ago, Brendan McCullum is the captain of the team. We're talking about, you know, a serious cricket team here. And they're going to be pitting themselves in a game of cricket against a team of total non-cricketers, most well rugby union players. That's the John Lumo connection. Interestingly, and it's always fun to find out these other sides of people. The brilliant Kiwi rugby player Israel Dagg apparently is a pretty phenomenal bowler, and he takes the attitude that having spent his life in the gym, you know, beefing up his arms and on weights machines, that he might as well just sling the ball down as fast as he possibly can. And apparently he can bowl over 140 kilometers an hour, but you're never quite sure whether it's going to take out a square leg or not on the way to the pitch. The cricket team, the rugby team does also have a wild card, I should say, which is David Hussey.
That's not a bad wild card.
It's not a bad wild card at all.
I,
Sorry, go on.
It also plays to this thing that, you know, you don't have to read that far back in cricket history to find these people who are very comfortably playing, you know, the Comptons, for example, of this world, who are playing cricket one day or one season and then football the next, and acquitting themselves at sort of world-class level at all. Now, professionalism has kind of left that behind. But I bet there's a part of some of these rugby players that might just fancy themselves, you know, that might just think, oh, well, sure, you know, maybe I could have been just as good as any of these cricketers.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Usain Bolt, for instance, has been sort of was the talk of the town a bit last year when he came out and signed for Sydney FC, I think, as a football player. And there always is that element of kind of competition and wanting to prove yourself. But the other interesting thing, I think, which is quite refreshing about this, is the fact that here you have a whole lot of sports people, particularly in the rugby players, who have spent their entire careers trying to make sure that when they go out on the pitch, they're absolutely fine-tuned and they're on top of their game. And here they are going out and willing to have a bit of fun against some really serious opponents as well. It's not as if it's kind of non-cricketers against non-cricketers. They're pitting themselves against a really fine team. And it's that kind of return to amateurism as much as anything, which I think is really delightful about this fundamentally. And I wonder whether it's actually got something to do with why New Zealanders are so natively sporty, the fact that they are willing to just turn out and try their hand at anything rather than sort of be precious about it somehow. From the archives, and this episode, Andy is going to be telling us about Arjuna Ranatunga, his runners, and the end of running.
It's January 20th, 1996, and Sri Lanka are chasing in an ODI against Australia. It's a hot, humid night at the SCG. Arjuna Ranatunga says he's injured and summons a runner from the dressing room. Now, the Australian keeper Ian Healy is somewhat unimpressed about this. He informs Ranatunga, "You don't get a runner for being overweight, unfit, fat." And I'm going to have to leave the quote there in order to protect our much-valued family-friendly rating on iTunes. Now, Healy's response might seem a bit rough. You know, poor Ranatunga, the man's injured. But you dig into it a little bit more and you can understand the keeper's frustration. Healy reckoned it was very obvious when the physio came on and made what could be described as limited efforts at treatment that there was very little wrong with Ranatunga. The Sri Lankan was on 9 not out at this point, which suggested that he hadn't, you know, there'd not been much exertion
there hadn't been
going
hundreds
on.
Singles.
What probably really added to this was Jayasuriya came on as the runner. Now, Jayasuriya, and this is a little bit hard to imagine now, because obviously I think a lot of us think of him more at the other end of his career. At this point, he was rapid, you know, the quickest runner in the Sri Lankan team. So that was just another thing to wind Healy up.
And I suppose at that point, we actually had a... It was when fitness was treated in a different way in the game. You know, we were still a long way off the point where cricketers were being left out of teams because they weren't fit enough. That became something, you know, particularly during the mid-late 2000s, there were certain English cricketers who came up against that. So actually, a kind of basic level of fitness wasn't, in a way, wasn't something you needed in order to be an international cricketer at that stage. I mean, you think of someone like Indomitable Hack as well. Actually, some of the greatest stars of the game were people fundamentally who did not want to run between wickets, and I think Ranatunga is an example of that.
Yes, you're talking about the sort of pre and post Samit Patel kind of phase of history of cricket. And of course, Ranatunga was a wonderful batsman, despite being rather portly. He was a sort of mix of a true force of nature and a complete wind-up merchant. One of his favourite party tricks was to walk singles, which particularly for teams like the Australians, for whom, you know, you are drilled as a youngster, you know, you run that first single hard. But it wasn't just a wind-up thing. It was actually quite clever. He used to gain overthrows from the fact that furious fielders would then hurl and miss. And his other big wind-up was again and again he would ask for runners, injury or not. Now, he never said this publicly at the time, but others have since said that he was very open in private conversations that he had identified this loophole in the rules and he would use it again and again.
So just to clarify, the rule was at that stage that basically anyone could ask for a runner at any time, or that you had to have some level of injury? I mean, whose discretion? What did the umpires have to approve it? How did that work in terms of the rule at that point?
It's a really good question, because I was digging through the old versions of the rules for this.
And, that is what we do for you, dear listener.
It's actually great fun. If anyone hasn't looked at the 1980 incarnation of the laws of cricket, you're missing out. Even having looked at the laws, it's not entirely clear, but the umpires had to agree, and the captain, I think, generally had to agree, although that bit, I think, was less clearly specified in the rules. I think that the issue is that there was generally seen to be very few, if any, situations at this stage that an umpire would sort of say no. I think generally once asked for, it was almost a given. Which I think got us to this point where in October 2011, and by this point Ranatunga is a couple of years retired, the ICC took the decision to outlaw runners from international cricket. Now, worth adding the caveat here, they did that, but the laws of cricket owned by the MCC, runners remain. So, for example, you know, we still have runners in club cricket for the most part. Now, the ICC chief at the time, Haroon Loggat, explained this decision by saying, "There's been a strong feeling that runners were used not in the right spirit. It's quite a difficult one for umpires to determine whether there has been a real injury to batsmen or whether it was a tactical use of runners." Now, for anyone who had seen the behaviour of a certain Sri Lankan captain, it seemed pretty clear who in particular he was referencing. Now, it's quite hard to say, you know, exactly whether this Ranatunga can take credit for changing the laws of international cricket. There was another key incident in 2009. So it's the Champions Trophy. South Africa are chasing against England. And Graham Smith, who'd already made 100 by this point, is heavily afflicted by cramp. And Andrew Strauss refuses him a runner. And I think cramp, you can see, is a particular nightmare for this decision. Because, you know, is it an injury? Is it a question of fitness?
Is it a fitness question, yeah.
Or frankly, once you've made 100, yes, you probably are cramping a bit. You know, do you really deserve a runner?
And yeah, is being tired a reason? Is that the same as an injury? You know, it's an interesting grey area there, isn't it?
Exactly this. And I think this was yet another example that I think informed that ICC decision that it was putting umpires and to some extent captains, I think, in quite an impossible position. Now, entertainingly, Ranatunga made an appearance even here. So in his post-match interview, journalists were quick to remind Graham Smith of Ranatunga and the fact that this was a man who had repeatedly got away with all sorts of requests. Graham Smith, however, said, "I don't know if I want to be likened to Arjuna. I think I've worked quite hard in the winter, which I think said a lot about how the game had changed. And this reflects, you know, on your point about can you get away basically with being an unfit cricketer, that by 2009, that was less and less acceptable, I think.
It does say something about Ranatunga's reputation within the game that that is the first thing that, you know, that the journalist thought of, and then that Smith thought of as well. I mean, there were certainly plenty of brilliant incidents when, you know, I was watching cricket growing up, watching international cricket, where, because runners do introduce a degree of confusion into the mix, and it was always a weird visual thing having a runner off and out at square leg, where there sometimes wouldn't actually be, you know, the crease lines wouldn't actually be marked, and so there was just confusion reigning in every single direction, and often they wouldn't, you know, the batsman wouldn't sort out who was actually calling. So whether it's the runner who calls or whether it's the batsman, the on-strike batsman himself who calls. And so it seems that we've lost a bit of colour in the game through that kind of sense of absolute chaos. But what's your opinion on it? Do you reckon that was the right way to go, to completely ban runners from the game?
I share your sorrow at the loss of the comedy and the loss of the very strange sight. It was always a strange sight seeing that trio in the centre, and maybe one day we'll return in one of these features to some of the more entertaining kind of runner exploits. But I think the point is that this was a rule of the age of gentlemen's agreements. It was a rule of the age of sort of, you know, a nod and a wink and everything was fine. And I think the more professional cricket became and the more intense the competition, I think the rule became very exposed and very under pressure. And I think it put umpires in a truly ridiculous position. I mean, to actually make a judgment on whether someone is hurt or not is, you know, not what they are there for. And I think the other thing here is that this is sort of just how the game evolves, I guess. You know, in a sense, Ranatunga pushing it too far and the game responding. I guess, you know, if you look at the laws as a whole, that tends to be how the game pushes on, doesn't it? Whether we're talking about overarm bowling, whether we're talking about fielding positions, you know, people try something unusual, they try something different, and the game tends to respond either by permitting it or by aggressively banning it, and it all becomes part of the history of the game.
And actually, when you look back as well at when you think now, if a runner were to appear in a test match or a one-day international or a T20 on the international stage, it would frankly just look odd.
I think it would look bizarre. One comedic suggestion that I did read somewhere in my research was that you could have evened this out by insisting that the runner who came on had to carry the same amount of weight as the person who replaced, so that a young Jayasuriya would have had to come on loaded up with enough weights to take him to Ranatunga size. To the review, and for this episode we've been reading Chasing Shadows, The Life and Death of Peter Roebuck by Tim Lane and Elliot Cartledge. This book tells the story of the life and death of Peter Roebuck. It really focuses ultimately on the unresolved question of Roebuck's death and looks into the kind of long-term questions behind it. It's a cricket book, but really only to some extent in the fact that it's a book about a cricketer. More than that, it's a portrait of a troubled soul and it's a criminal investigation. It was shortlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year and the Cricket Society MCC Book of the Year, and has also won the Cross Cricket Book of the Year and Australian Cricket Society Literary Award. Tim Lane was a former broadcasting colleague of Roebuck at the ABC, and Elliot Cartledge is a Melbourne-based writer who, I believe this is his third sports book. Now, we learn a huge, huge amount about Peter Roebuck in this book. It is a very, whatever else is said about it, is an incredibly serious bit of investigation. Huge numbers of people were interviewed. What stands out to you about it, sort of, if you were trying to pin down the personality, pin down the man?
Probably the fact that it's unpinned downable, actually. I remember when he died, I remember what a big deal it was in the Australian press, and partly that was because he was quite a remarkable figure in a culture that, you know, prizes cricket quite highly, but partly also because I think he's one of those figures that by being elusive is fascinating, that kind of character that you can't pinpoint actually really draws people in. It was interesting, I was talking to my partner, who's certainly not a cricket lover by any stretch of the imagination, yesterday, and certainly has never read a piece of Peter Roebuck's cricket writing. And she said, oh, what book are you reading for the podcast? And I said, oh, it's a book about Peter Roebuck. And she said, yeah, what was the deal with him? And it was really interesting to hear the fact that, you know, he had entered the kind of popular imagination to that point. Now, one of the things that this book does is it really explores the mystery of Roebuck without actually ever really giving you a complete picture of him. And he seems to have been a man of huge contradiction as much as anything. He was a man of many parts. He was a cricketer and he was a cricket commentator. He was a man who simultaneously was warm and generous towards his friends and, frankly, a pretty awkward person for people to get on with, you know, someone who didn't have many close friends at the time. And one of the things I think that the book does really well is actually to tease out all of that kind of nuance as well.
It does this, I think, through speaking to everyone. And I think this is one thing that, you know, you get all the different perspectives. And you made the point about the fact that even, you know, someone like, you know, who'd never engaged with cricket would know Roebuck. The way he was perceived around the rest of the world was so different to the way he was perceived in the UK by the end. And I think this is something the book really brought home to me. You have an Indian cricket writer, Rohit Mahajan, describing him as the conscience keeper of the game. Well, by this point, you know, we're talking in the early 2000s, his reputation in the UK had been, you know, really, really badly damaged by the court case and all of that.
Is it worth, I was just going to, you know, because I think that he is someone who has become infamous by his death, but there may well be listeners who aren't aware actually of the scope of Roebuck's career as a, you know, as a brilliant young batsman, as a prodigy who rose through the ranks at Somerset until he became involved in the hugely political fallout of the decision about whether to sack Viv Richards and Dol Garner because they weren't, you know, they weren't putting their weight in terms of team and dressing room culture. Ian Botham got involved in that, and that was the incident that kind of stalked the rest of Roebuck's life in many ways. He spent his life believing that Ian Botham was out to get him as a result of that. Then also while he was at Somerset, there was a court case around him caning boys who were staying with him, punishing them by caning them, and then most controversially in terms of the public eye, asking to see the welts on their buttocks, he claims, in order to judge whether he was caning them too hard, but in the eyes of some, as a kind of as a sort of voyeur and potentially with some kind of sexual implications to that. It was after that that his journalistic career took off, and he really decided to disassociate himself from the UK as well, and actually spent time between South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Australia. So it's this remarkable kind of multi-chapter career that he has. And do you think that there are kind of threads that run through it in terms of his? It's tempting to see it as sort of different people throughout, but do you think that there are threads that run through his life in that regard? Common threads.
I mean, I think there's an independent mindedness. I think the Botham Richards Garner scandal, I mean, I don't know if it's a scandal, a fallout sort of showed that. A willingness to be his own man, I think, came up again and again. I think he has recognised, one thing that I guess is easy to pin down is there is general consensus around the fact that at his best, he was one of the best writers out there. However, at the same time, a lot of very esteemed judges would say that his writing peaked, certainly his early books, including his wonderful account of his time sort of at Somerset, were him at his best. And then later on in his career, he worked himself phenomenally hard. I think most people felt like overstretched himself, you know, was writing for everyone, but succeeded in building this profile across India, this profile across Australia. And also there was this bitterness, as you said, you know, he did feel people were out to get him. And I think as we all, the vast majority of situations, I guess there are wonderful polemics that can be written through bitterness, but actually writing doesn't I think, often benefit from a kind of sense of, I guess, a sense of paranoia, a sense of being under attack.
Well, there are some incredible, it's incredible reading back some of the things, like his review of Ian Botham's autobiography, and he just uses it as an opportunity to absolutely take Botham down. And there is, on the one hand, there is this sense that he is fearless, and it's a fearlessness that comes out throughout his career. You know, when he was a Somerset batsman, actually, you know, considered very unlucky never to play for England, he was always the person who would stand up against the, you know, West Indies quicks and get hit on the head a few times. He was also, quite amusingly, a journalist while he was a cricketer, so he'd have written a column about someone and then be facing them on the pitch the next day and kind of have given them something to fire themselves up. And then throughout his career, he's always willing to call out authority. He takes on the Zimbabwean government, and some of the suspicions around his death centre around, you know, was this fundamentally a hit job by the Zimbabwean government on him because of what he had said. But at the same time, the fearless versus contrarian line, I think, is a very fine one, and you do get the sense that he does turn into a bit of a contrarian towards the end of his life. You know, when he does things like absolutely lay into Ricky Ponting, and actually then the next day apologises, but there's a column where he says that Ricky Ponting has to be sacked as the Australian captain, and then the next day comes back and says, yeah, okay, I went too far. This is a person of quite extreme personality, I think it's fair to say, in the way that he vacillates.
And you can see the attraction in attempting a biography of Roebuck. I think, as you said right from the start, you know, impossible to pin down and much more fascinating, frankly, than your average sportsman. I mean, this is a biography that is as interesting as a non-sports book. You know, he is a fascinating figure. My only uneasiness really around the book comes from, I think, particularly the sort of central chapters where there is a huge amount of speculation around Roebuck's sexuality and his sexual preferences. Now, I think you can defend this on the basis that if you look at the circumstances around his suicide, this all played in, and that if you're going to investigate it, you have to do it. But a part of me reading this did feel uncomfortable. You know, he was a cricketer. He wasn't a politician or someone who I think maybe has maybe made a pact that frankly exposes your private life perhaps more broadly. And some of it, the back and forth, I just felt, it felt voyeuristic to me. I think when you have one person saying one thing, and the book, through no fault of its own, doesn't get to a conclusion of that because the evidence just isn't there. But I wondered what you felt of the way, sort of the need to take those issues on in the book and the way they were handled.
Well, it's interesting what is the central point of the book? Is it about uncovering Peter Roebuck, the man? Because if there is, you can use the justification of the fact that, you know, the circumstances of his death, did he commit suicide or not? So for anyone who doesn't know, he was arrested in Cape Town for the sexual assault of a young man, and then either threw himself out of the window of the hotel room or was pushed, and that really is that, you know, what the book is kind of aiming towards. But the question is this a biography of him as the man that's looking into a kind of psychoanalytical portrait that leads towards all the circumstances around that death, or is this about him as a writer and as a cricketer? Because if it's the latter, then sure, you know, any book that is about a cricketer and wants to look at the man can do that. But you do feel, how far is it necessary to do that? How far, in order to get to know someone, do we need to know all of the details of their life? And you're absolutely right, because what the authors also do is they steer clear of saying, okay, the reason why we are looking into his homosexuality is because that's a really important way of looking about whether the sexual assault would have taken place or not. They never actually directly make that parallel. There's a sort of separate standalone chapter which is fundamentally, was Peter Roebuck a homosexual? And I agree with you, the way that that's handled is in many ways uncomfortable, particularly in the context of the kind of deftness and the humor which characterizes which characterizes quite a lot of the rest of the book. It's interesting that the family were worried about the publication of this book because they thought that it would prejudice ongoing legal proceedings, which really does indicate that it sort of strayed into territory that was a long way beyond what you might expect around the, the biography of a cricketer and a writer.
This is not a comfortable read. I think there will be a lot of moments in this book that I think, as a reader, make you feel quite awkward and quite, well, I guess forced to try and grapple in the same way that Roebuck's friends did with a complex personality. But I think it stands out as far as sort of biographies that we've looked at on this podcast before, in comparison to those, and I think is fascinating as an attempt, even if it doesn't get there, to get to grips with someone who I think will stand out for a while in cricketing history.
Now, just to close, I do want to read one short excerpt, which I think gives a brilliant indication of some of the kind of funny side of Roebuck's contradictions as a man, but which also point towards some of the darker sides. And it's from his days in Somerset, playing for Somerset. And it's a tale told by one of his colleagues, which he says this: "We played against Oxfordshire in an important 2-day championship game, and after 30 minutes he brought himself on to bowl. After his third ball, steam was coming out of his ears as the ball was doing bugger all on the pitch. He'd proceeded to sit down on the wicket, roughly on a length, and shout out, 'What's the point of life? What's the point of life?' as he bounced the ball on the pitch. For a full minute he sat there and no one said a word. In fact, it was quite hilarious. An hour later, he had taken 9 for 12," which I just think is a great indication of some of the kind of contradictions, inner and outer contradictions, of this man. So that was Chasing Shadows: The Life and Death of Peter Roebuck by Tim Lane and Elliot Cartledge.
That was the 108th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Do come and find us on Twitter at Reverse Swept. Always very, very happy to continue any of the discussions on any of the topics raised on this episode. And we will speak to you again soon.